Who Cares Wins? Phrase or meaningful question. A podcast for the deep thinker, the curious intellect, and for those who care deeply about the planet. Also, sometimes referred to as Who Cares Who Wins.
Hello and welcome to Who Cares Wins with me, Lily Cole. I'm deeply in love with and also very concerned for our planet. And in this podcast series, I want to unearth different climate solutions that we can get on board with, including looking at contradictions and divergent opinions. And in case you're not a walking Wikipedia, we'll be hearing more from our lovely producer, Kelsey, who'll be springing in from time to time to help clarify any moments or statistics for you. So, we're taking a little bit of a different turn in the season with this episode. As you may be familiar, in the season so far, we've been looking at some of the connections between climate change, its causes, its effects, its solutions, and different social issues, particularly looking at gender equality. And today, I've invited on someone to challenge some of this thinking. Now, I've thrown the word intersections around, I think, quite a lot this season. The concept of intersectionality has been around since the 70s as a way to understand how different types of oppression intersect and overlap, that different identities such as race, gender, class, economics, sexuality, disability can compound to create different experiences. And today I want to take a more radical turn and share a conversation with a political commentator who is very critical of our culture's increasing focus on gender and race as a way to understand our history and ourselves. Douglas Murray believes this trend is increasingly dividing our society, and Douglas has written several best-selling books on this topic, such as The Madness of Crowds, and his most recent work, The War on the West. It's a spicy episode, to say the least. Lovely to meet you in New York, I believe you are right now. Do you live there?
I am. I do. Much of the time I do. And you can probably hear the wonderful noise of New York log jams of traffic all the time.
I used to live there, so I know that soundtrack very well. So yeah, maybe to begin, I'd love to hear about your new book, The War on the West, and kind of, yeah, your thesis and the argument you're trying to make with it.
Well, yes, this is my seventh book. I've been a writer all my life. So I've now been a writer for almost 25 years, almost a quarter of a century. The latest book I've written has been brought out by HarperCollins. It's called The War on the West, with the subtitle How to Prevail in an Age of Unreason. I think there are a lot of things going on underneath all of us that are dividing us extraordinarily bitterly. I think that there's quite a lot of ways you can approach that, quite a lot of different directions you can look at it from. One of the ones which has really interested me in recent years is what I regard as being Western anti-Westernism. There's lots of different forms of anti-Westernism. There's Chinese anti-Westernism, Arab anti-Westernism. And Western anti-Westernism is the one that interests me most. That is, people in the West who seem to regard the West, Western democracies, Western societies, as uniquely bad, as uniquely evil, guilty, and much more. And I show how this has really having a very, very divisive impact in our societies. In America, where I'm sitting at the moment, you basically can't be much more divided without having an actual civil war. And I think in Britain in recent years have been a lot of things that have gone underneath us, which are really tectonic shifts. And one of the reasons why getting what I describe as a proper and reasonable attitude towards our past and ourselves, therefore, is good is because, you know, if you can at least agree on some of that, you've got somewhere you're going from. If you agree in the case of America that it's a striving always for more perfect union, it's not perfect, it hasn't been perfect, but it's been pretty darn good and it's done a lot of good in the world as a country. If you can agree on that, then a lot of the sort of current day stuff starts to It doesn't fall away, but it means you're speaking to each other as people who agree on a very important starting premise. I think it's the same in Britain. I think it's the same in Canada, Australia, New Zealand. And I've noticed in recent years just a terrible sort of rewriting of the past in an ever more hostile and negative light, so that, for instance, everything in the British past is now looked at through the lens of racism, colonialism, slavery. These are very important parts of our history, but they are not our history. That is not the sum total of our nation and its activities throughout history, let alone of all the people who've lived in it in the past. And it's the same with each of the Western societies. And I'm particularly eager to try to halt what I describe as the sort of really bad thought viruses of our time that have leaked in, such as the form of anti-Westernism that now claims, for instance, that the West is in culture guilty only of cultural appropriation. This is, to my mind, an incredibly deadly idea which has been pushing in from the margins in recent years. You know, you can't put and shouldn't put boundaries on culture. You shouldn't claim that some groups are the owners of certain sounds, texts, people. You know, either culture is for everyone or it's for select groups of people, and the second thing can lead to real hell. And in recent years, the anti-Westernists have started to focus on this and have really started to, I think, ransack the cultural terrain, both the historical cultural terrain and the present day one, so that people are sort of tiptoeing around, never knowing where they're going to land on a landmine. And of course, that's just, it's the enemy of creativity, it's the enemy of culture, it's the end of an actual exchange of ideas. So this and much more is what's been preoccupying me. And the war on the West is my best attempt to date to try to, between two covers, sum up what I think is going on and how we should think our way out of it.
So if you were talking to somebody that you describe as a kind of anti-West Westerner, would it be right to assume you wouldn't deny the horrific things that have happened in the past, which fill the kind of language and rhetoric of that type of debate, but you would want a more balanced approach that also recognizes the positives?
Yes, I mean, it would be absurd if we lived in an era where you couldn't talk about bad things that happened in the Western past. I mean, you know, it would be absurd if you were not allowed to talk about colonialism.
Or in denial of it, I guess, would
or
be.
Slave, or in denial of it, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But equally, it's absurd to only focus on these things and get yourself out of perspective. It's rather like, you know, I say that it's something like the difference between self-criticism and self-hatred, or the difference between self-criticism and self-destruction. You know, when we want to improve ourselves as people, we take legitimate criticisms on board, things that we could actually do with improving in various aspects of our lives. But if somebody is just remorselessly negative about us, we would be unwise to take that on in our lives, because the person in question would appear to be just somebody who dislikes us. And I think it's the same thing with cultures. I mean, I could go to Nigeria, as I have a number of times, very, very fascinating country. But I could go to Nigeria and tell the people there that, because of their history of enslaving people and much more, that all young Nigerians should regard themselves as born into guilt in the 21st century, and tell them that their culture had never produced anything, and all sorts of other things, all of which would be untrue and terrible. But like, they wouldn't listen to me. Why should they? Because they would recognize that a person saying that was a remorselessly unfair critic of their society, who wasn't willing to recognize that both, yes, they had slavery and enslaved people, but yes, they had stopped, for instance, and they'd done other things as well, and that it wouldn't be fair just to look at Nigerian history through the lens of Nigerian slavery. I know it isn't even fair in the world today to look at a state like Qatar, for instance, where the World Cup's going to be, a complex, interesting society, but it wouldn't be fair to say, well, Qatar, the only thing you have is your history of slavery, and so on. I think the locals would think that was a kind of unfair and unreasonable attitude. Well, I think it's the same with us. I think we should have a reasonable attitude towards our past, the bad things, the wonderful things, the good things we've inherited, as well as the bad. And that's really what I'm just urging people, is to get out of the masochistic mindset, get out of simplistic mindset that we've fallen into, where everything is just looked at through this same monomaniacal lenses. I say this just days after yet another example of what I call racist gardening has come out, with another botanical gardens in the UK deciding to look at itself through the lens of slavery and colonialism.
What are they going to do with the garden? I'm not familiar with that.
They say they're going to decolonize and...
But does that mean they chop down the trees?
And them back. I mean, in reality, of course, it's a classic one, as I say in the War in the West, it's a classic one, that the decolonizing botanical gardens, because, you know, these are flowers. They haven't done anything wrong. And, you know, the idea is the colonial periods, people went out and collected plants and they took them from these places. And well, yes, because botanists were interested in botany. You know, they say it in museums, it's described as retain and explain. You know, keep things that are good. And, you know, if you need to explain how they came about, but don't pretend that history was just, you know, horrible botanists going around and robbing the world.
Retain and explain does seem to be the approach being taken by Richard Deverell, director of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew. Display boards at the gardens will be changed to give further information on plants such as sugar and rubber in order to reflect their links to slavery and colonialism. But retain and explain is a more contentious position for institutions to take when their items are unique. And there's long-standing campaigns to repatriate artefacts taken by force from other countries around the world during the colonial period, and they're gaining momentum.
What you're saying reminds me a little bit of the approach of Steven Pinker. I don't know how familiar you are with his work.
But yeah, I know Steven Pinker's
work. Yeah, so the idea that actually we're progressing much more than we acknowledge because we fixate so much on the negative. I think probably everyone listening is quite familiar with the critiques of Western society that being voiced a lot today. What are the positives? What are the things that you would like to advocate that should be retained and celebrated and held on to?
Well, you know, one of the oddities of the anti-Westernism of our age is that everybody knows in a very fundamental way that it's bogus. If you look at where people in the world want to come to, it is Western democracies that are highest on the list. America first by a very long way. All the polls show that. A new UN poll just showed that again recently. As the number one desired destination of migrants around the world. And number two, three, four, I think Canada, Britain, I think Germany as well. And one of the things I say is, well, the footfall tells us something. Now, what does it tell us? Some people would say, well, it tells us that we're rich and people want part of that. Well, even that on its own isn't a bad thing. I mean, there are reasons why some societies are economically successful and others are not. You know, it's best not to be a kleptocracy like Russia, where a small number of people just get to steal everything. But actually, there are a lot of reasons why Western societies are the ones that people around the world want to come to. You know, I mean, there was a poll a couple of years ago that showed that one third of people in sub-Saharan Africa want to move. They don't want to break into Saudi Arabia to experience the joys of Saudi living. And they don't want to move into the Communist Party of China's territory. They want to move to the West. Now, this tells us something, I think. And the most I can get some people to acknowledge is, okay, yes, that's the movement that exists. You know, the boats going across the Mediterranean go in one direction. They don't meet boats coming south with French and Italian people hoping to make it to sub-Saharan Africa. And when people cross the southern border of the United States from Central and Southern America, they don't bump into Texans trying to flee to Venezuela. You know, I mean, the travel is in one direction. Now, here's the thing I think from that is, why not reflect on that and also reflect on the fact that this being the case, it's not an accident. You know, there's obviously something we're doing pretty well in Western societies. I would say a lot of things we're doing well. In terms of freedoms, not just personal freedoms and political freedoms, but artistic freedoms, cultural freedoms, and much more. Freedom of expression, so much more. And apart from anything else, the ability to celebrate every culture, you know, which is highly unusual in historical and in current global terms. So one of the things I say is, you know, well, since this is the case now, if we're doing something right now, and the footfall suggests we are, maybe we've done something right in the past. Maybe we've done some things right that have led us to this place where we are the countries that people want to come to. And I think that is the case. You know, there's an American sportsman who said something I've become very fond of, a man called Branch Rickey. We're only familiar to American listeners. Branch Rickey once said, luck is the residue of design. Luck is the residue of design. You're not just lucky in a country, for instance. It's not just that, you know, there was a total lottery. It's the places turn out well or badly, depending on decisions that people make there. And I think that although we've done many things in the past that are bad, like everybody, and done some things in Europe that are uniquely bad, nevertheless, we've also done some amazing things. And what we have in terms of accomplishments and attainments today are the product of remarkable men and women for centuries, getting us to where we are. And I think we should have a more gentler, more forgiving attitude towards them as a result, because we live in the thing that they've given us.
Thank you. I'm going to challenge you a bit on that because I'm curious. Sure. What you'll say. So I kind of on the fence on this one, because whilst I fully agree there are lots of amazing things about Western society that need to be celebrated, and there is, I think, a kind of masochism to just focusing on the negative that's really unhelpful. I think it's similar to the way, obviously, like kind of culture wars and identity politics is playing out. So with that, I really agree. But I've also worked a bit in the kind of refugee space, and the drivers for, you know, most people aren't, it's not kind of just, you know, oh, it'd be nice to live in a nicer country. A lot of it's being driven by necessity. So it's been driven by war. It's being driven by climate change. Increasingly, there's now more migrants because of climate change than anything else. And that, I would say, is actually connected because of the way our world is connected through globalization, through capitalism, through history, is connected to the differences between countries. And I think many people would argue that the wealth that's in countries like the US, the UK, etc., a lot of it's probably got very good merit for how it was developed. You know, there's many, many examples we could use of that. But arguably, a lot of it's also because of the history of colonization that allowed, you know, slavery to free labor, basically, to empower certain nations. And that, yeah, there's a kind of a historical, therefore, imbalance between countries. And also the West has been very complicit in wars and the arms trades in some of the countries that people are fleeing from. And when it comes to climate change, a lot of the communities that are on the front line of climate change are poorer communities that don't have the means to adapt. And so they have to move.
I mean, first of all, I mean, the idea that Western societies are uniquely or specially, for instance, guilty of theft, sort of, let's say theft, I mean, appropriation of wealth and so on, I don't think can be borne out by analysis. I think that the history, and Steven Pinker's work certainly shows this, the history of humankind is, and up to every age, including our own, is people taking other people's stuff, moving into other people's areas and taking over of force, dominating. And if there being no counteracting force for that, I mean, until the modern age, the current age indeed, and even now it's up for grabs often, as we see in Ukraine. Until the current age, you know, people didn't care much about that. Every tribe in Africa, every tribe in the Middle East, their history is a history of conquest, winning, losing, acquisition, and much more. That's the history of humanity. It's not the history solely of the West. What is interesting in what you might call a post-colonial period is that places where things have not gone well, you see always a claim that they haven't gone well because of the West and because of colonialism, which is a long way in the past now, of course, let alone slavery, which is now two centuries in the past. I mean, you never hear in Singapore, for instance, a call for reparations or talk of the appallingness of colonialism or anything else, because Singapore is doing very well. You do hear it in certain kinds of Robert Mugabe's Zimbabwe. He was always very keen to talk about the crimes of colonialism and the alleged theft of his country's resources. Why? Well, because he and his family stole all of their country's resources and always found it immensely convenient to have somebody else to blame it on from decades earlier. So there is an oddity in the argument about the West taking things, which is essentially that countries that are done well never talk like that. The countries that haven't do.
But the examples you give are obviously strong ones, and Singapore is obviously a good example of that. I'm not an expert in Singaporean history, that being said. But by and large, and I wasn't making the case that you Westerners are uniquely bad people that have stolen more. I think you're totally right. Human nature is elements good and bad across all ages, across all places. But it so happens that in recent history, in the last however many centuries, particular areas of the world that were dominant in trade and colonialism, etc., are now still the wealthiest countries.
With some exceptions,
but by and large.
Yeah, there are some very striking exceptions. I mean, India's doing pretty well these days as a global economy. The history of British colonialism in India is very, very complex. But, you know, there are many Indian scholars who say, look, there were definite downsides to the colonial period.
Well, Lily and Douglas are both correct. The USA stands as the largest economy in the world, followed by China, Japan, then Germany, United Kingdom, and then India.
There were upsides as well, not least being left an infrastructure of a skeleton of a state that meant that India was certainly in a much better position after partition than many other countries were. But more importantly, I think, is this question of, like, well, how do you do the balance on this? And I'm very keen to do the balance on it without doing a whitewash in any direction. But, you know, it has actually been estimated, for instance, that, you know, in the 19th century, after Britain abolished slavery and King George III signed the Anti-Slavery Act in 1807, after Britain abolished slavery, as I mentioned in the War on the West, it wasn't just that Britain abolished it for herself and her colonies. It was that the Royal Navy attempted to stamp it out across the world. I mean, Brazil had a slave trade into the 1880s. The Ottoman Empire kept slaving. And of course, you know, many countries still slave today. There are estimated to be 40 million slaves in the world today, which is more than there were in the 19th century.
According to the World Population Review, it is estimated that 167 countries still have some form of modern slavery, affecting an estimated 46 million people. Although it's now difficult to detect and recognise in many cases due to its underground nature and expanding and evolving definition.
But the British after, and again, I'm not by any means overriding or trying to ignore the appalling story of slavery, but the British, after they decided to stamp out slavery, spent an enormous amount of blood and treasure patrolling high seas for decades. And it's actually been estimated by scholars that in the 19th century, if you add the amount of money that Britain paid to try to stamp out this evil trade, and you include the fact that British households were paying more every year for goods because we were not willing to buy goods from slave powers, if you include all of this, it's been estimated by some distinguished scholars that actually Britain roughly spent as much money stamping out the slave trade in the 19th century as it ever gained from it beforehand. Now, does that mean that, as it were, the books are completely clear? You could say yes economically, but not morally, for instance. But it's a very important thing to consider, and it would at least should be put on a side of the ledger somewhere in trying to work out a fair estimation of our past. Like you, I've spent a lot of time traveling across the developing world in many conflict zones and all continents except one. And my own experience of traveling in and speaking with people in, for instance, the refugee camps, migrant camps in North Africa, the Middle East, and southern parts of Europe, is that actually most migrants are fleeing what you would have to describe as economic deprivation of various, caused by a various range of factors. I mean, that there are occasions where you get large numbers of people fleeing from war zones, such as in the early 2010s with Syria, and such as is happening now with Ukraine and people flooding into the neighboring countries. But these things do have to be considered separately. I mean, fleeing war is a particular issue and actually is of the different types of migration, in a way, one of the easiest to deal with, because as I've seen myself, you can keep people in the vicinity of the country they're fleeing in the hope that they can return and help rebuild their country whenever it comes to peace. But I would challenge the presumption that all conflict, or most conflict even in the world, is caused by Western powers. I mean, the appalling conflict in Syria, which is, you know, a decade old now, was not caused by Western intervention. In fact, you know, Britain, and in particular, and America, kept out as much as possible, with the bare minimum of intervening when, you know, ISIS attacked Paris and so on, and taking out ISIS camps. That aside, we had no meaningful intervention in that conflict. The countries that should bear a burden for intervening in the Syrian war, you know, primarily Iran, Russia, a couple of other powers. But we would not expect there to be a reckoning for any of those countries for having intervened, because we judge ourselves by a different standard than we judge other people. And sometimes that's correct. And sometimes it leads to a form of masochism, which I think is deeply unhelpful. I mean, migration is going to be perhaps the big issue of the 21st century, because it's so easy today not just to move, but to see what you're moving to. You know, it's happened in our lifetimes. I mean, every farmer in Africa can have a mobile phone and speak to relatives in Europe and know what they can go to. That changes everything. We've never had anything like this in our history as a species.
And do you also track like climate migration? And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they say now that there are more people on the move because of changes to climate.
I haven't actually looked, I have to confess, I haven't particularly looked into that. I've seen some of the data, I've seen some of the contesting of the data. I mean, it's certainly the case that parts of sub-Saharan Africa are places that people increasingly want to move from. I think that's a mix of factors are likely there.
Of the 30.6 million people displaced across 135 countries in 2017, 60% were as a direct result of climate-related disasters. And it's predicted that at least 1.2 billion people could be displaced by such climate-related events by 2050.
I mean, you know, then there are very unique cases, like, for instance, if you go around the migrant camps of Southern Europe and Northern Africa, you know, you meet a lot of people from Eritrea. You know, that's because that country has a terrible regime which puts everyone into the army at a very early age, and a lot of people, particularly young men, want to escape. And what do you do about that? I mean, nobody really knows. Who's to blame? The government of Eritrea? Is it solvable? I've never met anyone who thought so.
I mean, I've seen some of the things you've written and said about climate change. Would you say you're a climate skeptic?
Not said very much, I should stress.
Well, I found some of it.
I don't say very much about climate change. I mean, I stick to a sort of very unusual modern ethic of trying not to speak about things that I haven't researched deeply.
Okay.
And I regard the sort of climate change thing as something that that other people are studying, have studied. I don't deny that it's an important issue. It's just that there are quite a lot of important issues in the world. And I do think that, you know, trying not to speak about things that you haven't learned about is a good rule.
Yeah.
I mean, I have some instincts on it, and obviously I've done some reading and quite a lot of.
Would you say you are skeptical of the science, or that you believe in it, or?
Well, I'm skeptical of everything, pretty much. But I suppose I come from a position of skepticism on science. I'm more skeptical about several things. One is the extent to which we can do anything about it, and secondly is whether things we're doing are wise. I mean, I don't need to tell you, it's one of your areas, that, you know, the main polluters today are countries who, it seems to me, are unlikely to be persuaded to stop polluting. I thought at the recent COP26, I thought that Prime Minister Modi's intervention was in some ways the most interesting, because he was not going to attend, then did, and then promised that there was going to be a reduction in Indian emissions by 2050. And I just thought, you know, good luck holding him to that.
Mm.
Good luck holding him to that. I mean, you can tell me perhaps. I just don't know what the plan is when somebody like Modi says that. What does it really mean? What do you hold him to?
Will India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, promise to cut its emissions to net zero by 2070? Missing a key goal of the COP26 summit for countries to commit to reach that target by 2050.
It's one of the biggest problems, I think, with climate change political action is that our leaders have short leadership cycles in democracies.
Absolutely.
And this is a longer term. I mean, it needs immediate action, but it's a longer term vision and mission that needs to be striven towards.
Well, what about a country that doesn't suffer from short term electoral cycles? China.
Well, some people would argue they're able to make quicker decisions on action. I mean, they've committed to a net zero goal of 2060. And, you know, there's lots of examples of how they're doing great work in that space and how they're doing awful.
Have you been to China recently?
Not recently, no.
I can tell you there is very little scarier than being in Beijing and being told that the next day you might not be able to leave and go out because of the air pollution, and that the city is unlivable at significant points.
They actually launched quite a successful campaign a few years ago called the War on Pollution. War on Air Pollution, I think it was. And I think that air pollution will be a key driver in political action because it's a much more immediate, short-term, visceral thing that needs to be responded to.
Yeah, I mean, the Chinese Communist Party obviously knows that. I mean, you can't have your capital city unlivable. I mean, so even they recognize on that that you've got to do something. But I mean, the CCP's attitude is very important. As you know, they're throwing up coal-fired power stations all the time by the hundreds. And what is the Western view of that? It seems to me it's caught between complete inaction and the people who say, well, who are we to tell them what to do? Mm. And there is a strong movement, even it seems to me, among climate activists and left-wing activists and others, to sort of say, well, you know, we had an industrial revolution, so who are we to say they can't? And that's not a bad argument, actually.
Are you familiar with, like, climate justice as a movement?
Yeah, I mean, a little, yeah.
Sort of connecting, I think, the areas you look at in terms of social justice and historical responsibility with the kind of impacts of climate change, the responsibility for climate change. So, for example, the data suggests that Africa as a continent is responsible for about 4% of historical emissions, but is one of the continents most impacted by climate change. Whereas actually, interestingly, a country like China, although, you know, very polluting today, historically is not one of the biggest emitters because that's quite recent, their development.
Well, its industrial revolution came in the latter part of the 20th century,
And then you sort of get into the debates of, is it fair to tell developing nations that they're not allowed to develop in the same way that industrialized nations have?
Yeah.
How much should industrialized nations and wealthier nations support developing nations with adaptation, mitigation, loss and damage? There's quite an important and interesting and complex conversation there.
And of course, it's always to be remembered that, I mean, you're not dealing with parity between governments on this.
I mean,
it is totally separate dealing with even, say, a democracy like India and a totalitarian dictatorship like China.
And also in the negotiations, the wealthiest countries have the biggest power. So apparently COP26 was swung by a couple of wealthy nations in the end who edited the text, you know, in the last few hours.
Well, it would be the people who are going to pay the most will end up having the most say. I mean, that's the same in anything. I don't think it's terribly surprising. We might deprecate that, but it's inevitable, isn't it? I mean, you wouldn't give the world's poorest nation the say if it was going to affect them the least.
No, but it's going to affect them the most.
I'm saying in economic terms.
In economic terms,
benefit them the least. But yes, I mean, obviously there are countries that are very poor and which will claim a need to have a larger say. But I mean, I think it's a very, very messy area, precisely as I say, because I don't know what the mechanism is by which people expect to hold people to account in this. I mean, even the democracies are talking in terms and of achievable goals, which, I mean, you and I know that, I mean, there are achievable goals that are meant to be achieved this year, which there's no restitution if they're not, you know.
Do you think there are any changes that capitalism does need to make?
Capitalism is an enormously complex thing because it's not a monolithic ideology like, I don't know, like communism is, for instance. Capitalism is a means of doing things which, like everything, can go wrong and can go well. It's the best free market capitalism is provably the best way of enriching people and populations that we've ever come across as a species. I mean, as you know, I mean, all the data shows that, you know, until you basically get possibility for the free exchange of goods, you know, of human flourishing, the ability to accomplish things was minuscule throughout history. And, you know, in our own century, we've seen perhaps a billion people raised out of absolute poverty because of free market capitalism. And that can't be said often enough. And I say that because what I'm going to say next is a critique, but, you know, it's a friendly critique, which is that capitalism can go wrong in places. There can be bad forms of capitalism. You know, we all know this. Like corporate raiding, for instance, is a bad form of capitalism. I think that, you know, we are all in a very tricky situation at the moment in the Western democracies because of inflation and money printing and quantitative easing and all this of the last 14 years in particular. We have a situation where young people in particular are finding it very, very hard to accrue capital. And if you can't accrue capital, it's not obvious why you would be a capitalist. And I think that there's a very significant problem there. And in Britain, that's most evident in the housing crisis and the terrible difficulty that young people have getting onto the housing ladder. And it's not fair. It's not fair. And although our parents worked very hard to get onto the property ladder where they could, it wasn't easy. It shouldn't be portrayed as if it was, as if the boomers simply had a sort of wonderful, easy ride of it and were given money. Nevertheless, when you have a situation as you have now where average wages are something like a fifth of average home prices, and, you know, in some areas a sixth, an eighth, at that point, people are in real trouble about getting onto the property ladder. And that's an example of a bit of capitalism that's been going wrong. I have to say, that can be righted. I mean, not least in the case of the UK, by just building homes, which is the British government has been very, very lax about for many years. But the answer to that in a deformation within the capitalist system should be to improve it. Now, I'm always struck by the fact that so many of the critics of that, instead of saying, let's improve and get better capitalism, say, let's try socialism again or something, for instance, a system which has never worked anywhere and has destroyed and eviscerated country after country. So I just add that because it's a very frustrating part of the debate. You know, capitalism can go wrong like everything can go wrong. It doesn't mean the thing itself is wrong.
I write a lot in my book at how to evolve capitalism into a better version of itself. I think if you dig into any kind of climate science today, it's pretty terrifying, the situation we're in. And capitalism is not the only driver of that, but I think that some of the aspects of capitalism are major drivers of that, whether it's overconsumption, overproduction, the focus on shareholder profit legally without including other stakeholders. And all these areas are being looked at.
Do you think they're changing, by the way?
I think there are real signs of things improving, yeah. I went to the World Economic Forum, the last two ones, and the one before last, so 2020, they released a new manifesto. It was their 50th anniversary of the WEF. And the new manifesto was all about stakeholder capitalism. And so capitalism moving from the Milton Friedman logic of only focusing on shareholder profit as a legal responsibility towards actually legally shifting the framework of capitalism to embrace all stakeholders, so community, the environment, employees, etc. That hasn't happened yet from a legal, it's very voluntary right now as a movement. But I think the fact that an institution like the WEF would publish that signifies the trend in that direction. And there are other examples I could give. Laws against planned obsolescence, for example, in France might help rein in overproduction somewhat. So yeah, I'm optimistic things are going that way.
Planned obsolescence might need some explanation. It's when manufacturers design an existing version of a product to become dated or useless within a given time frame. So, for example, we might all be aware of why Apple were being investigated for it, and printing manufacturers Epson, Canon, HP, and Brother, all allegedly shortening the life of print cartridges. It feeds back into the point that Lily made about Milton Friedman, who said corporations have no higher purpose than maximising profits for their shareholders.
I wondered if there's anything, you know, as an advocate of capitalism, if there are issues you see, and also rising inequality, issues you see and ways you think we should be looking to mediate those issues.
But I mean, when you say advocate of capitalism, I mean, everybody in our society is an advocate of capitalism, a beneficiary of capitalism.
Well, there's lots of beneficiaries. There might not all be that many advocates.
Well, it's like saying I'm a beneficiary and an advocate of oxygen. It's like, it's true. But I repeat, that there is no other viable option on the table other than capitalism in some form.
Which can also be social democracy, right? There are socialist elements to capitalist systems.
Some like European countries, you could say that. Yes, yeah. You could say there's aspects of that. And I think, as you know, I mean, the examples you just give of, for instance, stakeholder capitalism, other things such as communities having the same thing, you've got to be very, very careful about that. I mean, you have to play with it incredibly delicately. It requires brain surgery. like precision, because, for instance, I know you saw SpaceX has had to, because of certain rules in America, you know, make compulsory donations to certain local enterprises in order to be pursuing what it's doing. Like, you've got to be damn sure that you're not going to kill the goose that's laying the golden egg in these enterprises. You know, you've got to intervene very, very deftly where you do in the free market. And that's not to say you don't intervene at all. And as for inequality, that's a very big and important subject, because it's always existed, it always will exist, it will always be with us. And I prefer to think, instead of inequality, I prefer to frame it differently, which is unfairness. Inequality is a very, very loaded and inexact term. I mean, we are all unequal in our lives in so many ways. People have an unequal share of good looks, unequal shares of money, inherited money, opportunity based on where they're born, their intelligence, their IQ, their education. I mean, there's so much inequality. And that isn't to say we should be totally accepting of it, but I think what we should be concerned about is unfairness in societies. And, you know, the way I frame that is that the thing that I think is achievable is, instead of talking about inequality per se, well, you know, there's inequality in sports. You know, the Olympics is a vastly unequal enterprise. People, and I mean, basketball teams are made up of naturally tall men and women. That's unequal. They have an unequal advantage in choosing to be a professional basketball player. And there might be somebody very small who'd love to be, but they just can't be. That's inequality as well. So what I say in regards to that, and I said this in my previous book, The Madness of Crowds, was how about finding something which we could actually agree across the board was an objective and see how we could get to it. And I suggest there that, for instance, we could, I think, agree across most political divides, if not all, that one of the aims of our society should be that nobody should be held back from anything that they can achieve if they have the competency to achieve it by dint of a characteristic over which they have no say. And I think you can get right and left to agree to that aim. You will disagree on how you can achieve that, but that is an aim that could unify people.
Yeah, and I like that. And I could see it working nationally. Could that work internationally?
Very hard internationally, because again, you know, the scene is totally different.
But that's an unfair, uncharacteristic, people can't choose, right, where they're born.
I know, I know. And if I was in China, I would love that to be achievable. But I mean, it seems to me that the Chinese regime, whilst they're running concentration camps, are highly unlikely to be caring about fairness.
Oh, I meant, sorry, when I said internationally, I don't mean in every country, I mean in between countries as well.
It's, yeah, I mean, you could do, but I mean, it would work between complementary countries, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I guess I'm just pointing out that there is an inherent unfairness in the characteristic of where one is born that we don't choose.
Completely. But, and I would add one rider to that, which is the rider that I sort of mentioned earlier in the Branch Rickey quote, which is, I mean, I was very impressed some years ago by a point. I always love it when somebody makes a point you actually haven't thought of or makes you think of it in a slightly different way. And some years ago, I was in Norway meeting parliamentarians there on a book tour. And one of the ministers in the government was a very impressive immigration minister. And she said to me, when I referred to luck and the bad luck of being born in certain places, she said something that is very pertinent. She said, you know, Norway has the same energy reserves as Venezuela. But there's a reason why we're Norway and they're Venezuela. And it's to do with the choices that we've made and the choices that Venezuela made in recent decades and were made for them by very, very bad people have completely immiserated a country. And that's not just luck.
Well, it is for the person who's born into the country that had nothing to do with the political
and
equation.
And that's the problem. Yes, that's the problem with luck. But you have the question of your forebears as well making good decisions. And I'm not blaming anyone born into Venezuela today, but, you know, the last generation in Venezuela made some exceptionally bad choices, and worse choices were then forced upon them, and their country's been immiserated as a result. Now, that's just very, very bad luck to be born into it. But it's not purely luck. It is the result of very bad decisions being made. And that is something which we also find hard to contend with, because we don't know what to do with that. But it's got to be somewhere in the equation.
Yeah, it's very challenging, because I love your definition of fairness, but I would want to, in my utopian world, be applying it to everyone globally, you know, which
But I mean,
it's a hard circle to square.
Yeah. As you know, when you go to a non-Western democracy, you discover that there are very, very different rules that apply.
I also think that a lot of the things that we celebrate in the West, like wealth, there are plenty of studies that show are not actually necessarily conducive to happiness, and there are high kind of mental health issues in wealthy countries.
I don't mean this in any way to denigrate the seriousness of mental health, but to have mental health issues is effectively a luxury for human beings. A luxury. Mm-hmm. Most people in history, and many people in the world today, don't have time to be depressed because they die. They've got to go and work. They've got to go and get a salary. They've got to scrimp whatever living they can. And they are likely to be as stressed and unhappy, if not vastly more so in many cases, than people in the West. But nobody cares about it and nobody has time to ask them about it because the simple business of existing is the priority. And that was what it was like for most of us throughout human history.
There's a great book, if you haven't read it, called Tribe by Sebastian Younger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, where he kind of makes the case that community is one of the most important components to mental health. And therefore, that sort of explains why, in many ways, you have high mental health issues in some developed nations. And, you know...
Community, family, circle of loved ones and people...
Relationships, essentially.
Relationships. And also, of course, never forget whatever one's views on it, is a religious belief. They're very, very high up in the list of things that just reliably across religions and everything else is a cause of happiness. So, yes, and I do think that, again, it's something you have to address in the modern economy, which is that there are many people who are effectively cut off from a community. They don't have a community of meaning. I mean, they might have people around them, but, yes, that is a problem that can exist in the modern capitalist society. And even identifying it does some good, doesn't it? Because it encourages people to realize they have to seek that out then.
And the lack of community and the lack of religion, do you think those are drivers towards the manifestations of identity politics, woke culture, what you call new religions?
Yes. I mean, I think that it's effectively, there are a very limited number of ways in which you can belong, you know, and they all have downsides. I mean, I just have to admit that from the outset, you know. Like national belonging is the best, widest form of belonging that we've come up with as a species. You know, the third person plural of we the people, where you can claim responsibility for things you actually haven't done and also can feel, you know, sadness for things that you have. National belonging is perhaps the widest form of belonging, although the world now is exploring other ones. I mean, there are communities now, you might say, that are post-national. But there are limited ways of belonging. National is one. Religious is obviously a very strong one. And that works across, transcends boundaries of culture and much more. Transcends national boundaries, obviously. There are other belongings of belief. There's racial belonging, which exists and which we know about the downsides of.
And would you maybe describe what you call the new religion of, I guess, identity politics, culture wars?
I think identity politics is an attempt to do identity after the nation state. It is to say where there are downsides to national belonging, which the 20th century told us. And there were problems of ideological belonging because of the two worst experiments in human history that both happened in the 20th century, the nightmare of fascism and the nightmare of communism. So we know the ideological community belonging risk as well. And I do think that people are trying out at the moment different ways of belonging. I mean, you know, I happen to be gay, but I don't feel I'm part of any gay community. But there are a lot of people now, increasing number of people, who are exploring that. They want to be part of the LGBTQIA plus community. And they want a whole month to celebrate that, for instance, where we used to just have the odd march to demand a necessary adjustment to the law. I think people are experimenting. Would you agree that, I mean, women, to an extent, have been experimenting belonging as a woman to a community as women? I think that's true, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Would you not say that's true of men?
I don't think it's true of men because I think that men, it's not permissible in the same way. Because I mean, there are men doing that. There are men's rights sort of movements.
Yeah.
I think it's like we don't mind in the main if people say, in fact, I don't mind at all if somebody says I'm very proud to be black. But we do mind if somebody says, I'm very proud to be white. So I explore a bit of that in The War on the West, but it's a bit the same with the men and women thing. We, you know, if somebody says, I'm just so proud to be a woman, I love being a woman, that's great, we like that. And in a way, it's because it's a correction to things that have happened in the past that have been very suboptimal. But we don't like it if somebody says, God damn, I'm just so proud to be a man. The sort of, you know, it makes us cringe.
And do you think that's a problem?
I think it's an interim phase, both of those, actually. I think it's a correction to the fact that in the past, in both of these cases, people did not have as many rights.
And actually, it's interesting you chose the word proud, because with the LGBTQ movement, I mean, the concept of pride is a response to the history of shame and criminalisation,
yes,
etc.
Quite so. But again, I mean, I believe that these things have a point at which the correction should be finished.
And do you think we've reached that point in any of these movements?
I think so. I think that gay rights are at the point where, you know, you can accept that equality is just putting up with the same crap everyone else has to put up with. You know, it's like you don't get special months, you don't get endless corporate sponsored, you know.
In certain places in the world, I guess, because there's still many countries.
Well, that's another thing, because it's the Wild West and worse in many countries in the world. And, you know, I'm always conscious when I'm in a country where homosexuality is illegal. And, you know, it's very, very sobering when you meet people who, you know, are gay and will sidle up to you and will speak to you after something. And the world is different outside the West.
Did you ever, and feel free not to answer if it feels too personal, but did you ever feel like shame around your sexuality or the need to come out?
I was able to find enough heroes, predecessors, who could help me find my own way to a reasonable attitude towards that. Some were alive, most were dead. And the opportunity of that for people now growing up is just infinitely better.
Yeah.
I mean, I often give the example that, you know, when I was growing up, like, there were gays, but I mean, like, you know, there were some in entertainment, there were some writers and others, but like, until Peter Mandelson was outed on Newsnight, you know, there wasn't a gay politician that was, you know, note. And that was only the late 90s. And now, you know, gay bankers, gay everything. It doesn't, you know. Well, I think I have a dislike of the word queer being used now by people who aren't actually same-sex attracted and saying, you know, I'm queer because I feel kind of sometimes feminine, sometimes masculine. I can think, well, that was a word that we didn't like hearing in the past, and I don't like seeing people use that. But no, I mean, generally, I managed to find my way to what is my current belief, which is that, you know, I have no shame, should feel no shame about being gay. But the flip side of that is no particular pride either. I'm proud of some people who did extraordinary things in the past, but I had no connection to that, really. I admire enormously the brave men and women who fought for gay rights, like I admire the extraordinary men and women who fought for civil rights in America and for equal rights between the sexes. I massively admire these people. I can't say I personally feel pride in any of their actions because I feel that it's not something I was personally able to be a part of.
And with women's rights, I mean, obviously loads has been achieved in the West and other places, but I speak for the West in my experience. But there are still lots of data points you could look at where women have less equality, whether it's, you know, representation in political spheres, economic equality, etc. Do you feel like we've reached a settlement, or do you feel there's still work to be done? Or what's your thoughts on kind of gender?
I think we're very confused about it, because I go back to that suggestion I made. How about we agree that nobody should be held back if they're competent by dint of the characteristics? So I hope we're there. We won't be in every field. Also, by the way, it's hard, isn't it? Because we always end up talking inevitably about high prestige jobs. You know, all of the representation stuff always focuses on prestige employment, the top rank of politics, the Hollywood, you know. I mean, the most unusual, uncommon places end up being the things we wrangle over. And I think that we're in a deep confusion about this, because the thing I've suggested as being a desirable aspiration, that if somebody is able to do something, whoever or whatever they are, if they can do it, they should be able to and they shouldn't be held back, doesn't mean that everything is going to look completely representative. I mean, you know, like, there will probably always be a disproportionate number of gay men in certain fields, for instance, and there's not much you can do about it or should do about it. There will probably always be an overrepresentation of men in certain fields and an overrepresentation of women in certain fields. And there's no shame in recognizing that and having some kind of peace with it. I mean, I don't think there's any shame in the fact that, for instance, among elementary school teachers, you know, there's a predominance of women. is because they're more inclined towards that profession. Now, it's, equally, it's not surprising that there's a predominance of men in certain professions. Mm-hmm. The question is, what about professions where women would like to be represented and are being held back?
And I think that's why prestige jobs are often focused on, whether it's Hollywood or politics.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, nobody cares about the fact that, for instance, most of the tarmac road layers in the UK are men.
Yeah. The cleaners are women, you know.
And the most of the cleaners are women. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's unclear to me what we expect to do about that. And whenever I'm told, well, you know, equal representation on boards, I think we sort of try to tinker with a lot of the most prestige stuff because the stuff underneath that is harder.
I want to circle back towards the beginning of our conversation around a cohesive society versus a divided society. It strikes me as almost paradoxical that you're advocating for a more cohesive society, as I understand it, so kind of critiquing these very divisive elements in our society, which I personally really agree with. And yet, actually, you're quite a divisive character, I would say, politically speaking.
I think it's an appalling thing to say. I'm ending the podcast now.
What would be your hope or your recipe for how we could bring together? I mean, I don't necessarily agree with all of your political positions, but I really am happy to have a conversation because I think it's so healthy in society to have intellectual conversations with people who don't always agree with you. Yeah, what would be a recipe in your mind towards finding common ground and trying to bridge? You know, I think that a lot of the identity politics movement and woke culture has really like a lot of merit to it. I think that there are historical injustices, there are existing inequalities today that need to be examined, and they often overlap. And yet I really dislike the very divisive, as you say, quite simplified rhetoric that I think is actually not helping progress on a lot of these issues. So do you have a sense of how we can find a common ground that allows us to recognize underlying aims, but find maybe more cohesive ways of getting there?
Let me start on the personal and then end on the general. On the personal, just because you mentioned it, I don't find myself a divisive person. I don't live my life as a divisive person. Inevitably, if you put your opinions out in the public square, people will agree or disagree on them. And that's just something you have to accept. If you have often sharp-edged opinions, as I do, because I think I write about issues which are, you know, difficult issues. I mean, I think that's one of the point of being a writer. I mean, I could write about buttercups and daisies and how much I like them, but, you know, I'm more interested in difficult things. And inevitably that divides some people. I would always urge people, and I'm not just saying this to myself, but in general with anyone who puts their ideas out there, public figures, to actually engage with what they're saying and not a version of what you think they're saying. I mean, I really do try to read, you know, my critics, people I disagree with, and I do it because I'm genuinely interested. Sometimes they've got something right, sometimes they're onto something. And sometimes, at the very least, as you know, John Stuart Mill famously said, you know, I'm going to sharpen my opinions. I don't know only half of an argument. And I have to say, very disappointingly, I don't find that that favor is returned. I don't find it's reciprocated. I was once on Swedish radio, and there was a discussion about one of my books. And one of the discussants I discovered afterwards, because the discussion ended up being in Swedish after I'd left, was talking about my book. And the other person said, well, you know, have you read it? And he said, no. And she said, well, why? And he said, because I know what Douglas Murray thinks. And she said, well, how do you know if you haven't read his book? I mean, and it turned out he had no idea what I thought. And she wiped the floor with him. But anyhow, it's inevitable that there's always going to be division. I think that there is a very, very important thing I've learned in recent years, which is you've got to try to find things you agree on. And this is something I sort of say at one point toward the end of the war on the West, which I've discovered since, by the way, is something that marriage counselors, relationship counselors, among other things, say, which is, you know, with couples who are warring, like, find things you agree on and try to hold on to those things, and then maybe find other things and points of common reference and things. And I think that's the same for society. So it's been very nice meeting the marriage counselors coming out of the woodwork since my book came out. Wasn't expecting that.
That's amazing. I love that.
Yeah. The other one, by the way, is people from Alcoholics and Anonymous, because one of the things I also say is the importance of learning gratitude in our societies, not just criticisms of our societies and the past, but gratitude for the things that are good. And then quite a lot of people have been sidling up to me saying, have you ever been in drug rehabilitation or in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I say, that's a very personal question. And it turns out that it's because people are saying, actually, you're asked, as I understand it now in rehab and others, to list the things you're grateful for. And that's a very, very wise thing to do. And anyhow, so I'm always interested. I discover these things.
You're secretly a New Age counsellor.
And accidentally and implausibly. But I think that on the general thing, that is the most important thing, is to try to find things you agree on. In America, for instance, you know, I have this very, very basic one I say to my American friends and others, which is try to agree on who won an election, you know? Try to agree on that. Like, I mean, if you can't agree on what you've just had, you're in real trouble, real trouble. But there's one other thing, which is, to try to find people, you know, I did a tour in Australia and New Zealand a few years ago with Cornel West, then of Harvard, and we did a tour. He describes himself as a revolutionary Christian socialist, and I do not describe myself as this. But we did a tour of 6 nights or so, and it was really, really enriching for me, and I hope for him as well, and I hope for audiences. There's certainly a wonderful feedback, because we both said, look, there's enough of people from different political sides talking about each other. Why don't they talk to each other? You know, why don't we learn from each other? Why don't we try to develop some trust? And we tried to inculcate that every night that we talked. And one of the things I realized also is it helps if you've drunk from the same wells. You know, it helps if you've drunk from the same wells. If you have some common reference points, some common reverence points as well, I would say. Some people you mutually admire, some things you mutually agree on. If you can find those things, you're not completely lost, and you never will be. If you can't find anything like that, wow, are you in trouble personally and as a society. So I do think we need to work towards that. I'm always delighted to speak with anybody who disagrees with me, agrees with me. It's much more interesting people who disagree with me, because I'm more likely to learn something. And I hope, because it's not just an exercise in that, we can collectively get somewhere that's better.
I completely agree. The movement that's very divisive that we've been talking about is often people attacking each other, even though they have very similar end goals. Yes. And aims.
Yes.
But there's just difference in the nuance and focusing on those differences rather than focusing on the commonality of the direction. Yeah.
Well, sadly, that is a human trait, what Freud would call the narcissism of small differences. And, that is a very big one. People who just want to fight sometimes. And you have to notice those people and keep a million miles away from them.
Just to round it out, anything you're grateful for you want to share?
I'm grateful for so, so much. I can't tell you. You know, I think about it all the time. I'm very lucky. I might have opportunities none of my predecessors did, none of my ancestors did. I can travel the world. They weren't able to do that. People traveled once and then never saw their families again, you know? It's totally different now. I'm grateful for so much. I walk down the street and I look around myself and think, wow. I cross Broadway and I think, how the hell is this staying up? This is amazing. And I try to live my life gratefully, because the alternatives are bitterness and resentment and much more, and we all have that chance. And of course, you know, people think it's easier to be grateful if things are going well for you, but I think we've probably also all known people in our lives who have very little but live lives of amazing charity and gratitude and generosity, and for me, those people are some of the people who I've learned most from and I try to follow.
Thank you so much.
It's been such a pleasure.
Yeah, it has been. I have to say, I have so many reasons to be grateful in my own life. And I would personally also list the ability to travel around the world as kind of top of the list, because I love traveling and I've got to travel to some extraordinary places. And yet I'm also painfully aware that that's a privilege that many, many people, particularly migrants, are not being given right now. Though there were a lot of political opinions in that conversation that I disagree with and would have challenged further if we had more time, I do agree with Douglas on the fundamental need to speak with and listen to people whose opinions are different to our own, and ultimately to try and bridge the political divide and to focus on what we share and on the visions and values we share rather than focusing so much on our differences. As Evelyn Beatrice Hall once wrote, "I disapprove of what you have to say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it." So in conclusion, after these conversations this season, I'm left wondering, is it possible to keep an intersectional perspective and to recognise the issues of race, gender, class, and how they connect with inequities today, whilst not fuelling further division in society, but rather focusing on solutions towards the fairer world so many of us want to see? Who Cares Wins is taking a short break and will be back in 2 weeks to present some stories of some extraordinary women I've been lucky enough to speak to and meet. In the meantime, we'll try to keep you feeling hopeful and inspired with weekly drops of reasons to be optimistic. Speak to you soon.
Thank you so much for listening to Who Cares Wins with me, Lily Cole. We are so grateful for the guidance and resources from She Changes Climate on this series, an organisation enabling women in all their diversity to lead just climate action globally. And for the music that's been provided by the very wonderful musician, Cosmo Sheldrake. If you like this episode and would like other people to hear it, we'd be so grateful if you would rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts from. And to hear reasons to be optimistic, we have another little Who Cares Wins drop this Friday. This is a Mags Creative production. Catch you next time. Bye.